Hello, my name's Brian Dwyer. This is Apollo Bay Radio and The Book Show. With me today, Megan Harrison, Lynn Halloran and Lee Kelly. Megan and Lynn, what a wonderful weekend it was with the Writers' Festival.
Yes.
And Warm Winter Words was a bit of a highlight.
Oh, I'd struggle to pick. I actually enjoyed everything I went to.
Yes. Mm. Well, firstly, I mean, there were poetry workshops, which I didn't get to, but I think Gareth did a great job with those. Mm.
He ran one, and the other was Biome Organics, which I didn't see, but I'd seen him previously at the school, so I've seen what he can do.
Then there was the comedy debate on Saturday night.
Yes, with yourself performing.
Yes, they dragged me out of...
your support role.
The support role into the limelight, and I must confess, I kind of enjoyed the limelight too.
You did well.
But we lost to the brilliant Damien Carney. And anyway, apparently Apollo Bay has now seceded from Australia.
Hasn't changed my life yet.
We await developments and political infighting, which is inevitable. Mm-hmm. So that was Saturday night. Then Sunday, after the workshops in the morning, Warm Winter Words. What was your highlight, Lynn, from Warm Winter Words?
I don't know that I could pick. I think each speaker was quite different. Mm-hmm. And the topics they had were very different. No, I can't pick. I thought they were all really good.
Were wonderful. Look, the woman who ran the works of writing, a life writing, how to write a memoir.
Is it Lee Kaufman?
Lee Kaufman, a 43-year-old former Russian-Israeli immigrant to Australia, has written three novels and a memoir, The Dangerous Bride. I can tell you, I raced home and look, I'm up to about page 115 and it's a racy tale, I can tell you. The Dangerous Bride, a memoir of love, gods and geography. Mm. It's interesting as she talks about how geography affects your writing. That's an interesting idea.
Can't say I've heard that before, but...
Yeah, David Malouf said something like that many years ago about, because he was from Brisbane, he said that the hilly terrain affected the way people thought, that they developed a sense of neighbourhood, and because they couldn't see very far.
Isolated a bit, I suppose. And he does always have a very strong sense of place, I find, in his writing.
Yes.
But I like to point that, the geography affected even, she found, the relationship. So in the Russian, she was there till 13, I think, and she was saying, because you'd have seriously three generations of family living in one room, there wasn't a lot of... sexual
intimacy.
Activity and that, So I imagine the same would go with writing. If you don't have that solitude and that time and that space and quiet, that would be, affected as well.
Yeah, and I think, and she came from Tel Aviv to Australia at, mid-20s, and she said she found that so refreshing, that you could stretch your arms and not hit people, there was space. And she even enjoys, she tells it, she enjoyed living in Bundura, of all places. I thought, there's an optimist.
Yes.
But look, it's a wonderful book for a start, about a memoir of a young woman who did not accept that monogamy was appropriate for her. So it's a tale of various relationships and the sort of negotiations she made with the various men in her life. It's a pretty interesting read, I can tell you.
It's just a desire since she was young and seen the film Henry and June, which I know I've seen, but I can't remember. I have to dig it out.
Yeah, it kind of made you, I want to go and see that now. I want to see what triggered it.
I don't remember it well.
Well, she talks in the book quite a lot about it and about reading the diaries of Anais
Anin,
yes, and Henry Miller's Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn, which is, and the point she makes there, and she devotes a chapter in the book, is that both Aeneas and Henry, in their adulterous affair, drew on June, and they both imitated her. They wrote about her. They much of their mutual desire was based on
her,
on June. Yes, it's really interesting. So anyway, she writes about that, she writes about other celebrated ménage à trois, you know. And I mean, it's pretty interesting. Not actually an erotic book. It's a book, and she spoke about this during the workshop. It's a book of reflection about events in her life, and the focus is on the difficult relationships she's had with men. And I mean, she's only 43 now, you know.
Memoir too,
and happily married. She
said, "Yeah, but didn't fall in love until 30 something,
34 yeah. something, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting, and the bravery it takes to stand up in front of people and say that sort of stuff, you know, it was astonishing. You didn't go to the workshop. The workshop was wonderful because she kind of gave instruction on how to write a memoir, and her advice was focus on some aspect, whether it's let's say losing one's religion or the death of a child or whatever it is. Focus on something. Don't write an autobiography because that's just sort of an endless list of facts. Make your focus clear. Pick six events and describe them in detail. Then you'll know whether you've got a book. And that was her advice, and it was pretty good, I think. Yeah. So anyway, a workshop I would recommend if she ever comes back. And so her talk was very entertaining. Yeah, very entertaining. Is there anything that struck you about her or her talk?
I just thought she was very comfortable, which I thought was really important given the topic. And also she does sort of touch on other reasons why, you know, she did sort of state that she had scars from obviously injuries when she was younger. And she sort of, you know, goes along the line of maybe I sought therefore more the need for people to want me. So if they wanted me. So she sort of goes into it quite openly and not entirely totally sexually. It's more sort of like a need to be wanted or
desired. Is there a lot of that in the book?
There is. Yeah. There's she fesses up to being an Israeli princess, and she says that she consciously adopted the role and played the role.
Okay,
she was a princess. She wanted to be rescued. She wanted to be looked after. She wanted to be desired, and she made it happen.
The ultimate Cinderella complex.
Another woman in whom I was very interested was Robin Nelson, the Yorta Yorta woman, who spun a fascinating yarn. Do you remember the name of her grandfather?
No.
Thomas S. James. Wasn't Thomas that S. James. Striking about his story?
I was in awe of her dedication because it was such a long process, research of it. But I was also, I was fascinated by this idea that he appeared with so little known about him in this mysterious character. And I loved what, was it four children or five children he had? And they all had, different stories of where he'd been or where he came from. I loved that idea. I wonder if he played on it, like as a bit of a...
Well, essentially, it appeared that in his lifetime, no one ever really found out the truth. It was only after
one of them had it, but they weren't sure.
Yeah.
including where his grandfather was buried, which wasn't him.
Yeah. So it's the story of a man who somehow came from Mauritius, from a family which had been a slave family in Mauritius. So
originally from Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka.
To Mauritius.
Brought to Mauritius as slaves. And he had somehow come to Australia and he'd...
studied at Melbourne Uni.
Yeah.
But he'd arrived in their community with five or six languages.
Yes. Ooh. In a Yorta Yorta community up around Echuca or around the Murray somewhere.
Yeah.
And in that community he had been the religious pastor, the school teacher.
The healer.
The healer, the pharmacist and the electoral officer.
but also she said to children outside the community as well. So
his fame had spread and people would come.
Yeah.
Yes. And he educated white children as well. And
I could understand how even her 13-year-old father would be fascinated by having a grandfather like that.
Absolutely.
Or a father like that.
A father, yes. So the story is her father... Robin Nelson's father tried to find out and tell the story of his own father, Robin's grandfather, and couldn't get the details. And after many years and two trips to Mauritius, she finally unlocked some clue and found out and wrote the biography.
Mm.
And just seems like a wonderful, wonderful project. And she, the interesting thing was she was celebrated in Mauritius. She was invited back, all expenses paid, because it was considered such an addition to their cultural
heritage. That he'd come here and done so well.
Yeah. So interesting. Did you love Emily Zoe Baker?
I thought she was incredibly entertaining and very vibrant.
She was.
Energetic.
Fabulous. A young woman, possibly about 30, hard to tell with young women, but she was a performance poet.
She was.
And
she
was a sensation.
Mm. I'd like to know how she remembered the poem she did. That was astounding. It was a brilliant poem, but also the fact that she just...
Well, look, she did have an iPad open.
Yes.
Oh, she still presented it very well.
Yes.
Yeah.
The delivery was very good.
It was very, very good.
Brilliant. It was an epic poem dedicated to every woman who's ever lived.
Throughout the history of time. Yes. And it's actually I love that it's actually available. Is it for
$5?
$5. Yes. $5 and every cent goes to the acid victims of girls in India.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. But the images that she had to pair with her poetry too, I thought they were fantastic.
You've very well put together.
Mm.
It's on YouTube.
Yep.
Mm. That was the Apollo Bay Writers Festival. Put it in your calendar for next year. It'll be the last week in July, last weekend in July, and it will be fabulous.
Yes.
You're listening to The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. We've been talking about the Apollo Bay Writers Festival. What have you been reading, Megan Harrison?
I have been reading 12 Angry Men for school. How boring
is that? Is that the one about the jury?
The play, yes.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah. It's sort of worthy but dull.
Oh, it's only dull because I have to study it. If I could just read it for pleasure, I think I'd enjoy it. But as far as texts go, it's not that bad. Yeah.
Yeah. You've taught that, Lee.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, and that was a long time ago, is it? They usually change them over, don't they?
Oh, this is year 11. They had to bring up a book that they can compare. It has lots of themes of justice and prejudice, and it's nice and easy to...
You'll have to explain to them what an L train is, though.
Critical
piece of evidence.
Yes.
And for our listeners, that's an EL, elevated train. Lee, are you continuing your voracious reading habits?
Well, I have been away for a few weeks, so I'm a bit rusty at this. But yes, one of the reasons I like being involved in this program is because it makes me read things that are outside my normal interest area. Yes. So I have been reading Tony Jordan's Our Tiny Useless Hearts on in preparation for this. Uh-huh. But I've also been reading, went back to an old favourite of John le Carré. I think I've read virtually his whole repertoire, but a friend of mine managed to find one that I hadn't read, so I'm into that. Right. It's called Our Kind of Traitor, and it's one of his modern ones about, you know, the Russian sort of criminal code.
Post-Cold War.
Yeah, yeah.
How many has he written?
It's a lot. I went through a really massively smiley's people phase when I was at uni. I just read absolutely everything. I loved that. But I have really enjoyed, you know, it's not the same, but I still think he does do a ripping good read.
Yes.
When he's done those post-Cold War texts. They're probably not as, the characters in them aren't as memorable.
Yeah.
But, I still enjoy it. As they're the only sort of book like that that I read.
I've seen films of two of his books, and they've both been really good. That one in Africa with Ralph Fiennes and I've forgotten the name of the actress, but anyway, it was all about, you know, conspiracies and corruption in third
Constant
world
Gardener.
Country. Yes, that's the one.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Yeah. As a film, I didn't read the book.
There's also been one that's been on Netflix or something, The Night Manager. And I don't get Netflix or anything, so I haven't seen it. But
we've just finished watching that, and Gareth read it while we were away, and it deviates largely from the book, he said, yeah.
But again, it's about contemporary crime and corruption.
Yeah, and it does. You always feel when you finish reading a John le Carré book, you just can't trust anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
They're all rotten to the core, you know. But the way that he weaves things in and he surprises you, he's masterful at doing that. Like a character that you thought was heading along a certain track, it turns out they've got this dark underbelly, or else they're actually some operatives that you didn't know about. And so he constantly surprises you. So that's good.
Megan, you spoke with perhaps Deb or John about Alain de Botton's...
Yes, The Course of Love.
The Course of Love. Mm. And that night I was actually listening to Alain de Botton. I haven't read the book yet, but have you finished it?
I have.
And did you enjoy it?
I did. It's actually it's being reviewed tonight on the ABC Book Show. I'm really looking forward to their review.
They can't be as thorough as us, surely.
I think they have a bit more time.
Yeah.
And a few more resources.
And they have an editor. The book club I'm in is also, we're meeting next Monday, and that was our last book that we, so I've read it for that as well. So
I've read quite a lot of the press about the book, and they give you summaries of his main points, and an articles by him about, not what happens in the book, but about the ideas in the book, and it's his critique of romanticism and its impact on our attitude to personal relationships, the mythology of marrying the right person.
Oh, yeah.
Or that there is a right person. Mm.
So he kind of deconstructs it all and offers advice, which is interesting.
Mm.
Anyway, fascinating talk. And his article, which was a summary of his talk, is also fascinating, and it's available online if you just... enter Alain de Botton romanticism into your web browser.
There's not enough time in life to do all these things.
No,
there,
right? Well, it's about 3,000 words, so it's kind of readable, you know, without spending too much time. Wonderful. But look, Megan, inspired by your comments, I read Alain de Botton's How Proust Can Change Your Life.
Really?
It's a wonderful, witty book.
Have you read Proust?
I've read 100 pages.
That might say a lot.
Now, having read Elaine de Botton, would you pick it up again?
I will.
You will? Okay.
I will. I understand what he is talking about. Marcel Proust wrote about the time of the First World War in France, and he's a man who could write 40 pages about having trouble getting to sleep.
Mm.
40 pages. But the thing is, it's not dull. Mm. It's not. He is just a fabulous writer. Mm. And the thing that I recall about my fairly scant reading of Marcel Proust is the richness of his figurative language is breathtaking. Mm. Anyway, How Proust Can Change Your Life is a sort of shortish book, 190 pages or something, very witty, broken up into very readable, you know, accessible chapters. And he goes through all these things that you can learn from the wise sage. How to take your time, how suffering can teach you wisdom, how to open your eyes and appreciate the familiar things, how to express your emotions rather than speak in cliches and platitudes. How to be a good friend. This is my favourite chapter. Spare your friends your honesty. Conversation does not and should not express our deepest selves. Conversation is just for social practicalities. Writing allows you to think about your friends, but don't do it in conversation. Good advice, I think. How to be happy in love, and his advice is simple. Introduce some jealousy into the relationship.
It's a little bit controversial.
Well, he says, look, the problem is people get complacent, and there's only one antidote, jealousy.
Mm-hmm. He has a very different view in The Course of Love. But, yeah, he actually puts forward the idea that if you're going to be unfaithful, it's not a sign of you not caring about your partner at all. You must care about them immensely because...
You're keeping it a secret.
Well, you're taking that risk. If it wasn't a risk, then there'd be no emotional bond that you're actually potentially putting in danger. Yeah.
Yes. And look, just to hark back to Lee Kaufman, the memoir writer.
Yeah, I was going to say, there must be a line back to her. And Tony Jordan.
And Tony Jordan, yeah. Lee Kaufman goes through all the theories about how a marriage can survive adultery. And it's pretty interesting. She does an appraisal. And needless to say, she's a little bit dismissive of the psychiatric industry, she calls it. She says no. She didn't find it convincing.
Well, a lot of those, the themes of power and perception can interplay there, can't they?
Yes.
You know, whether his comments about love are probably pure, but in the reality of the social mix, there's so many other things that are going on.
Mm. Yeah. I don't think Proust or Alain de Botton are recommending adultery. They're recommending jealousy.
Okay. The idea of
deception.
And the final chapter I found really interesting too, and that is beware of idolatry. Do not idolise writers. And he gives the example of tourists in France going to a childhood home of the great Marcel Proust. And he says, they waste time and money. They go there. They discover it's just an ordinary house like a million other ordinary houses. And they feel somehow cheated. And he said it's because they've mistaken the fetish for the real experience.
That harks back to that when we started with the book club about Alana Valenti and the way that she refuses to acknowledge who she really is because the story has a life.
Yes.
That is not her, and the story must live and die by its own value, not by interviews with her or knowing where she lived. Or,
But I wonder how her publisher copes with, you know, the 8-week publicity thing, which seems mandatory now. If you publish a book, the publisher trots you around the nation.
Her translator.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was at the Writers' Festival.
Mm. Her translator.
Her translator. Her translator.
Under close scrutiny. No secrets. This is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio.
This is Tony Jordan, and you're listening to Brian on The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio in sunny Apollo Bay.
In setting out to write a comedy, I think it's actually a tricky thing to do, because if you're writing just beautiful prose, there's degrees of success, right? You can be Tim Winton and write something like that's here, and then if you're just a little bit under that, you're under that, and it's kind of like a scale. But when you're writing comedy, it's either funny or it's not. Like it's you can fail really badly, and I think that's quite a scary thing. And I also think perhaps people don't understand quite how difficult it is to make someone laugh off the page. I know we have brilliant comedians in this country and television shows and, you know, Catherine Kim and everything, but they have faces as well and clothes, and they can, you know, they have their tone of voice. I've got nothing like that. I've just got ink on paper to try and make someone have that immediate emotional response. So I think that's quite tricky. So there's a few things that I've thought about in writing comedy that I think is quite important. And the first thing is, I think that it absolutely has to have something very serious underneath it. I think this is really crucial. If a comedy is just about jokes and there's no heart in it, I think it's flippant and fluffy, and you might smile or be amused for a minute, but it doesn't stay with you in enough way to make you laugh in a kind of serious, proper way. I think about the American comedian Mel Brooks when I think about this. You know, he did those films like The Producers and Blazing Saddles and those ones. He used to say, tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die. And I can see we laugh at that, right? But because I think that something very serious underpinning comedy not only makes it work better as a joke, but it also makes it more meaningful. Because the point of comedy is when we laugh at something, we take the power away from it. We exert our own influence of it. We remove its ability to hurt us in a way. So I was thinking a lot about that as well when I was writing this book, because on the surface, all the things about, you know, infidelity and marriage breakdown, there's absolutely nothing funny about that. When you're in the middle of that, laughing is the last thing you want to do. And I have had, you know, as I've already just told you, two marriages go spectacularly ballistically meltdown. And, you know, when that happens, I can still remember, you wake up in the morning and for like about 20 seconds you're all right because you've forgotten that infidelity has happened. You just wake up normal and then you remember. And then it's like somebody's actually carved out your chest. It's like there's nothing you can think about for the rest of the day in that. It's like a weight pushing on you. And if there's anything I wish I could do with this book, I wish I could go back in time to my, you know, just dumped self and say, I know you think you will never recover. I know you think that you will be like this forever and this will be, you know, your world from now on. But actually, you will recover. Not only will you recover, but you'll get to a point where you'll be able to look back on it and look. And this is kind of a love letter from the future, thinking about how you'll be able to kind of process those kind of thoughts. The other thing that I thought a lot about when writing humour is this idea I've been kicking around about the nature of fiction. So I'm still hopelessly obsessed with fiction. As I told you, I still write 2 books a week. People say to me, you know, something, 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 my kitchen rules, and I go, what is that? Because I just have no space in my brain for anything other than, you know, reading books, novels. And the thing I love so much about it is reading a novel is not a passive process. It's not like when you're watching TV or sitting on the couch and you're seeing everything on the screen. You see everything, you know, what everyone looks like and what they sound like. The movie of the book is taking place in your head as you read it. You have to conjure all these people from what you think that they might look like. So in this way, there's only ever one of every single book. There's only ever one copy, because every book is 50% of the writer and 50% of the reader, that one individual person. And together, the meeting of this, you know, my publisher says this conversation of two people who most likely will never meet, this space in the middle where 50% of me and 50% of you, even if we don't know each other, create this one individual thing that's only ever exists for one person at one time. Mm. I was thinking about this a lot with humour. The thing about this that really, it's funny, that really came home to me was when I was doing a book tour for another book, my first book, which was called Addition. And in Addition, Grace, the main character, she has this boyfriend called Seamus, and he's kind of the, you know, the love interest of the book. And I was doing this event outside of Adelaide. I'll never forget. It was a library like this. Like just out to like Adelaide Hills or something, and we did this chat and the bookseller was there and people bought books and came up and I was signing them. I was chatting to this lady as I was signing and she was standing there and she said, oh yeah, they were all in the same book club, these few ladies, and she said, oh yeah, we read the book in the book club, I really loved it, I really loved all the characters, she said, especially that Seamus, she said, you can tell it's fiction because men like that don't exist in real life. And I thought, oh, that's lovely, you know, what a nice thing to say. Signed her book, we chatted, off she went. And then the very next lady, like the woman who's behind her, came up, signing her book. She said, I really loved it, really loved the characters, except that Seamus, what a controlling shit.
Tony Jordan speaking a couple of weeks ago in the Sandringham Library, and that audio, a little bit rough, I apologise for that, but courtesy of Text Publishing, it is reproduced with permission. Lee Kelly, you've read Our Tiny Useless Hearts by Tony Jordan. What did you make of it?
Well, it's interesting listening to some of the things that she said, because I think she did quite achieve her objective of writing a very funny book, but something that did have something to say. I was shocked when I started to read it because I hadn't expected what I got, which was farce. Like it really is like it reminded me of, you know, my husband Dennis loves, you know, Fawlty Towers and would watch it again and again and again. And there are some episodes of Fawlty Towers I just can't watch because they're too painful. Just tell the truth.
Yeah.
Tell the truth and get this done and out of the way. There's moments in this book where it's you know, just from the listener's point of view, it has situations where people are gathered in a place and their relationships are all falling to bits and they're all challenging one another. And you just think, why not just leave?
Yeah.
Why not, especially the character of Alec. Why didn't you just go, Alec?
Yeah.
But then there'll be some really funny line
and
you roll on with it.
She did talk about that in the extended tour. She said in the first chapter she'd introduce something with just a little bit silly, and in the second chapter something a little bit more silly, so that by about chapter 10 you'd give it up on things making sense. You know, like she'd sort of seduced you into this world where stupid things and silly things happen.
Yeah. I did think she was really, really clever in the way that she captured the reactions of the two young girls, Mercedes and Paris, just the way that they would say things and do things. And I thought, that is so like kids.
Yes. And the kids being the sensible ones, of course, and the adults being the irresponsible and dishonest ones. That's funny in itself.
Yeah.
Mercedes and Paris, of course. So in her talk, that was her first thing about having a serious theme and using comedy to kind of take away the power of that horror, you know, that terrible stuff. And she did say that the moment she decided to write the book was when she read Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. Mm. And the first chapter, it says, the affair had just been discovered. And this is Anna Karenina's brother, yeah. who, you know, is a totally unreliable person, has had an affair with the maid or something. And she said that's where she got the idea of a family breakdown.
Yeah.
But unlike Tolstoy, she wasn't going to write an epic tragic novel. She thought, oh, no. She's going to make it funny. And she based it on, is it Molière, the French playwright? And it's a bedroom farce. I mean, you got men hiding in cupboards.
It's actually in the bed.
Yeah.
One of the most ridiculous scenes takes place. Yeah. Where none of them can find their clothes. Yeah. You know, and it's like, oh, for God's sake, how much stuff can be on the floor? Sure, you can see your clothes. That's just the rational me just thinking. Mm.
Yeah. And, there's a knock on the door. No, gosh, no.
Yeah, and people knock on doors and they never just stay there and wait for someone to come. They always wander in and, you know, go wherever they like. And, of course, they're going to find you hiding somewhere.
Yeah. And the other thing that she said, which I found really interesting, is that reading is such an active thing. I love that little anecdote about two of her fans approaching her at a book signing and having totally different readings of the same character.
Mm.
So I think that she kind of did that well too, because she said she was conscious in writing it of those dreadful American comedies where they have a laugh track, you know. Yeah. Which tells the audience what's funny and what's not.
Mm.
And she said she consciously tried not to do that and just take the risk of letting the audience laugh when they'd laugh or not.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Brave. I found it. I don't know if I've got time to do this, but I was just showing it to Megan, a really funny little example of the way she writes. She's talking about Leslie, I think it is, or one of them's into vintage clothes. You know, and she says, I only allow natural fibres near my skin, feel the material, etc. And the response is, they're creepy, that's what they are. I bet your dry cleaners have a sweep guessing which bodily fluids are responsible for which stain. They're an olfactory wonderland, your clothes. You can see the worn patch at the front. This is the bit I like, where the paramedic was banging on some poor old girl's chest. So you... Yeah. So you just, I felt like when you read it, you've got to be, and I suppose it's because I read a lot, you've got to suspend your judgment about, the likelihood of such events taking place and just enjoy the language and the way that they're playing on each other's responses and not expect the narrative to, go very far or...
And that applies, I think, in everything you read. It often takes me a little while until I twig, I'm in this genre. Because often you don't know at the start.
Yeah, and I was thinking, when we were talking about this idea of discussing classics that we like, some of the classics that I like are writers like, I always call it Proust, but you and I say things completely different way.
We do, yeah.
I like some of those writers that... we'll spend 40 pages creating an environment that is so all-consuming for you. You know that you are completely immersed in that environment and the narrative actually doesn't develop much.
No.
But like they've spent so much time taking you to this place and you are totally there.
Yeah, Thomas Hardy in a wheat field.
Yeah.
There's a... Patrick White is divisive like that too. Mm.
There's a book, I actually was in a bookstore in Colac the other day and I saw it, it's been re-released, called, I think the guy's name was Hoeg, H-O-E-G, you'll say it differently, Brian. And it's Miss Simler's Feeling for Snow.
Oh,
and that to me, I picked that up, some... swap in some European city, I don't know, I knew nothing about it. I was just mesmerised by it because it's about this person who's so in tune with their environment that they can see the differences between types of snow. Oh, just,
oh really?
Yeah, it's just, and that's a different type of reading. You have to slow yourself down and be find pleasure in that environment that you're in. And I think Tony Jordan's like that. If you're not expecting the story and you just enjoy those lines, there are some hilarious.
Yes. Yeah, and she did speak about the importance of dialogue and because in real life, dialogue tells you so much about people. You know, when you go to parties and you meet people, you know, you form your impressions, don't you, on what they say.
Yeah.
And she said she was really conscious of that in writing the book. And she was also very playful. She was talking about, you know, that people often betray themselves by the things they say.
Yeah.
And in that book, I think they do, you know. I love the, you know, the sort of socioeconomic aspirants.
Yeah, the descriptions of the house, you know, and that sort of modern minimalist bench. And
naming their children Paris. And and
they say that at one stage. She said, I thought for a long time about those names. That's all very funny.
And look, we were talking earlier about infidelity, and one of the opening scenes is the dad figure explaining to the kiddies about why he's leaving the marriage.
She really nails that. And the kids, the sisters are sitting there not replying, and he's going off on all these tangents and describing all these things that they won't get.
He said he's been on a diet of mangoes for 15 years. And he said, much as I love mangoes, it is very funny. She also spoke a little bit about, you know, writing itself. She said after she's written a book called Addition, which I believe is being made into a film, and a book called Fall Girl, for which she also has sold the film option. And she says she was so chuffed with her success. You know, she's thinking, oh, I've made it. I'm this big star writer. That she wrote 160 words, thinking she had this, you know, trilogy going or something. And her editor told her just to throw it in the rubbish bin. It was rubbish. She said it was really deflating. Like it took her 2 years to do it or something. And so anyway, that's when she wrote a comedy. And she also spoke about the process of meeting the film director.
Oh, yes.
Mm.
I can imagine that, you know, the casting for something like Our Tiny Useless Hearts would be because those sort of actors that would take on those sort of roles would layer them with their own nuances as actors. You know, you can imagine Melissa McCarthy, isn't that the one that's in Bridesmaids and all those ones, you know. You couldn't get someone like that to do this because it's not about that sort of being overtly humorous. It's being ridiculous. It's more the Kath and Kim sort of stuff.
Are they sort of iconically Australian, the characters that she's written?
No, not really. Okay. No, but there are references in it. And actually, I was thinking about this. If I was editing it, which I'm very unlikely to be ever in the position to do, I would take out some of the more contemporary references she puts in, like Frozen and pulled pork rolls and stuff like that. Because in 10 Nutella years, donut, people won't even know. You'll date yourself.
Yes, yeah. I'm sure the film will. And she did talk about that process of just having to let it go.
Yeah.
It's not her work anymore. She's sold it.
And I'm sure lines like that one about description of vintage clothing, you can see where she was trying to do CPR on the old deer. They're the sort of lines that will stay.
One of the things I really liked was that she said she's not a visual person herself, although I found, you know, I could visualise all that, everything really quite well. But she said in order to create her characters, she went on dating websites. And she read the descriptions.
The profiles.
And written about themselves. What a perfect way into
fantasy and fiction.
And it gave her the ideas for the characters. It's,
I actually thought, you know, on the, like, going back to her idea about how she did have serious points. She did want to say that about love and understanding
yes.
the nature of your heart instead of just, you know, your pride and all the other things that might interfere. And I think a description of how Janice felt about Alec, well, there were some really touching little pieces in that about how she felt about, you know, she just wanted to touch that little piece of skin behind his ear. And it was sort of interspersed with all the comedy, but it was actually quite poignant, I reckon.
Yeah, I felt so too. I'd recommend it. I really liked it.
Yeah, I think I'd recommend it, but I would tell people what they were getting themselves in for. Just so they keep going.
Now, Megan, I'm sure you'll be interested in this. She did confess that as a writer, she's not a plotter. She said she's written, whatever, 5 novels, and she's never known how they were going to end. She says she's not a plotter, she's a pantser, as is she flies by the seat of her pants, which I found very encouraging. This is the Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. The Writers' Festival, Megan, was so wonderful, and we did omit to say
well done to Peter and to Jane and all those involved with organising it, because it was a big extension from the normal Warm Winter Words to a festival.
It was. Frankly, I was a little bit worried that we had bitten off a bit more than we could chew. Not that I did anything, but Libby did so much publicity, and Pete did so much sort of the logistics.
No, and I thought there were fair crowds at all the events, from what I saw. Yeah.
And I was, to be honest, surprised the Poetry Slam was such a success.
Yeah.
Sunday night.
I was nervous that there wouldn't be that many people willing to put up their hand, but I suppose that's the thing. It's that budding poetry. There's more people doing it privately at home, and it's really an opportunity to stand up and deliver.
And, of course, Annabelle was a star.
Although difficult to judge when Pete and Libby were two entrants as well, so that makes it hard.
So well done, Pete and Libby and Jane. Jane has been involved with Warm Winter Words for how long? She doesn't even know how long. It's in the vicinity of 20 years. Lynn, what's happening at Galapagos Books?
Okay, well, first of all, I just want to mention, because finally they've released a book that I'd read several books ago, but as I said, I'm fortunate to get pre-published ones. It's called The House by the Lake, and I rather liked it because it is actually a story about a house, which sounds very unusual, but it is a memoir of sorts, because this chap goes back to his grandmother's house, which was built on a lake, which is obviously by the title. But it then goes into the history spoken of through the occupants in the house, but it touches on the fact when the Nazi regime took over, at the bottom of their garden is where the Berlin Wall was built. So although it's talking about the house and the occupants, it also delves quite a bit into the political sort of sphere that went around it. So I just found that really interesting. To have that sort of political sort of interest and a bit of history and everything else. And, yeah, intriguing to have the Berlin Wall built at the bottom of your garden.
Yeah. So is it a memoir?
It is a memoir. The chap, basically the house was about to be sort of, I dare say, demolished or whatever, and he just suddenly decided that he wanted to have a look at the history of it because it had been a fairly important point in his family's history. And then when he delves into it, he sort of finds out the different families that lived there. His grandmother was forced out of the house because of the Nazi regime, and then different people took it over. And as I said, then he also gets into the fact that the Berlin Wall, and he touches on The fact that, you know, one side of the wall did really well, one side stagnated, et cetera, et cetera. And, yeah, I just found it really interesting because it had a historical component. So
yes, and a nice follow-up perhaps to people who've read Stasiland, which we spoke about some weeks ago.
And another very quick one, they've just released under the guise of James Patterson, called Hot Shots. They are very quick reads. They are $6.99, wonderful price point. He's got 11 titles to date and they're still coming out, so they're just very quick reads. But he's also put his name, obviously, to his usual ones that he has, so they're sort of crime, etc. But I just got two in today that are romance, which are obviously written with another author. I'm quite sure James didn't do them. But, yeah, they've just brought them out as being, you know, a quick read, $6.99.
Are they for children? Or?
No, they're actually for adults. Yeah. They're actually, just a little, you know.
Very cheap.
Very Penny Dreadful type thing. Yeah. Women's Weekly for that.
What an interesting idea.
It's an interesting, you know, they just call them Hot Shots.
Back to the Pulp Fiction.
Bit of the Pulp Fiction. So, yeah. But as I said, they're obviously using other authors as well. I thought they were going to just be all of James. But as I said, I received a romance today. So could be interesting.
All of that at Galapagos Books. You're back from your holiday.
What are your
opening hours?
At the moment, I'm open basically every day bar Wednesday. I still have Wednesday off to catch up on a bit of paperwork at home.
Right. Megan, we won't have time tonight, but it's interesting that you and I both recently enjoyed Julian Barnes's The Sense of an Ending.
Yes.
We'll have to talk about it in detail.
It was good.
One night. It won the Man Booker Prize, and it's actually more of a novella, isn't it?
It's
not a long book.
No, quite brief.
Yeah. And it's fiction. It's narrated by a retired man called Tony Webster, who recalls his school life and his university life. And it's what's so interesting is that... having told you all about this in the first 50 pages or so and about his first serious girlfriend and all that, the narrative jumps 40 years.
Mm.
Something happens which calls into question his memories. Are they true? Are they correct? And calls into question so much about his life.
Mm.
Things that he felt... were true about himself. You know, if someone asks you to describe yourself and you go, you do that, you give people an impression of who you are and what you are, and you find suddenly that, hang on, you're not a reliable narrator.
No. I actually listened to part of it as an audiobook.
Oh.
And I think it was over within one drive to Melbourne and back. So, it's quite brief, but yeah.
Yes. Anyway, highly recommended, and we will talk about it again. Megan Harrison, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Lynn Halloran, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks to Lee Kelly, who we hope will be back as a regular panellist. There'll be no program on the 9th of August. All of our presenters are out of town that day. And then on the 23rd, Les Cameron, Dennis Sharples will be in to talk about science books.
Mm.
And hopefully we'll see you on that night as well.
I'll think about it. I could do science fiction, but I don't know if I could do science books.
This has been The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. Thanks for listening and we'll catch you next time.